Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A million people are set to gather today at Liberation Square in Cairo. This cell phone message to NPR from an Egyptian woman suggests a tone to the change that is afoot.
Hi, this is Mona Saif from Cairo. I just wanted to let the world know that we have been disconnected from our last point of communication through the internet. They did this before. The only difference is the last time when they did this, I was completely freaked out. I was so scared. This time, I'm not scared at all.
Joining us today to talk about this is Omar Keshk. He is a senior lecturer in Ohio State University's Undergraduate International Studies Program, Department of Political Science. He was born in Egypt, grew up the son of a journalist, and became a naturalized U.S. citizen in 2002. His mother and all of his family, except for siblings, still reside in Egypt. Welcome to the show, Omar.
Thank you, Ann.
We're hoping joining us later will be Richard Herman. He is director of the OSU Mershon Center for International Security Studies. He might have gotten caught in the ice. We don't know yet. First of all, Omar, are you concerned about your family? Are they safe? What are you hearing from them?
I was very concerned, but I've talked to them on a daily basis. They're really taking it easy, and they tell me not to worry about them. Their only concern is at nighttime with the looting, but it's almost like a neighborhood watch is going on. My mother will say the men from the apartments will go down at night, you know, wear their jackets, carry sticks and stuff like that, just to watch over the neighborhood. But other than that, there really is no concern. I ask about food. Do you have food and stuff like that? She says, no problem.
Are they in Cairo?
Yes. My mother's in Cairo. Well, all of my family that's really immediate is in Cairo, yes.
Let's listen to the rest of that cell phone message from the woman in, from Cairo. Let's hear what she has to say.
I want to tell them, bring it on. Mubarak is going out. Bye-bye.
She sounds young, almost giddy, and I wonder if this is the sense, is this a typical of the demonstrators alone, or is the nation as a whole feeling that giddiness? What is your sense?
At first, it's amazing that somebody would say, Mubarak, bring her on. I mean, it shows that we're living in a completely different world. If somebody said something like that, I think a year ago, I don't think they would be around too long.
They track them down.
Yeah, they track them down. But I think it shows the sense that there's a momentum there and people are not afraid anymore.
What were people afraid of before? When we talk about Mubarak, he's been in power for about 35 years. What was it immediate for people that he took on this role as a dictator, or was it something that creeped up on them and they turned around one day and realized they were losing their freedoms?
No, I think it's a continuation from the days of Nasser and Sadat and Mubarak is a continuation. I don't want to defend Mubarak, but I would say that he is a little bit more open than the previous two. But we don't want to exaggerate how open that was.
Yeah, it's everything's relative.
Relative, yes.
Okay, joining us now is Richard Herman. He is director of the OSU Mershon Center for International Security Studies. His work focuses on international relations and political psychology. His areas of interest include American foreign policy and the politics of the Middle East. Welcome to the show, Dr. Herman.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you.
We were talking about, relatively speaking, the president, Mubarak, and his predecessors, that maybe he's a little more gave a little bit more freedom to the people, but relatively speaking, not much that more. So this has been going on for ages.
He's served longer, and I think the regime has had economic growth the last several years, and with not very much opening and very little political change, I think the combination of increasing economic growth and some of the modernity that produces with very little to no change, it makes the no change much harder to take and seems much more severe. So I think if you're looking at the trend lines of the degree of reform and change needed, given the kind of economic and educational climate Egypt has become, as well as the youth element in Egypt, is just pathetically little. Oh, I mean, just way too little. And you're seeing the result of that in the street.
What's happened there is being compared and contrasted to what happened in what is happening in Tunisia And it also brings back memories of last summer in Iran because of the social media aspect of it. Some people have said and compared it what has happened in Cairo particularly as like a flash mob. They're just showing up out of nowhere. Of course, now the Internet's been shut down and they don't have that benefit. But is that part of that cultural change, just the whole social media?
Yes. I, from what I'm reading, it's not out of nowhere. It's out of Facebook, and it's out of other youth organizations, which are now aligning with their traditional organized opposition groups like the Muslim Brothers, and they're working with El Baradei and others. So I think we're going to see the consolidation of some kind of united front under these various umbrellas. No, but it began with young people in their 30s and 20s, largely through Facebook conversation that got the initial protest movement begun. So, but it isn't as if it was just a flash mob that just occurred out of nowhere.
It just appears like that sometimes. 614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call, you can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest today to talk about the political change in Egypt, Richard Herman. He is director of the OSU Merchant Center for International Security Studies, and also Omar Keshk. He's a senior lecturer in OSU's Undergraduate International Studies Program in the Department of Political Science. You mentioned the Muslim Brotherhood. It's part of the uprising. It's probably the one organized group in opposition up to this point. Should there be cause for concern among those who hope that a true democracy comes from all of this? Given that, Omar?
I hope not. I think while Egyptian people tend to be religious, it's a private matter. I think the Muslim Brotherhood is given a little bit too much emphasis in the Western news. I'm not concerned at all that they're going to seize power or seize the revolution or whatever is going on. There's an elephant in the room, and that's the military.
Right.
And they're certainly not going to allow that. I certainly don't think that it would be a good start to democracy if they're excluded. But I'm not that concerned about it. And I don't, talking to my mother and my cousin, there was not a single concern that this was being hijacked or anything by the Muslim Brotherhood.
You mentioned the military. This is a huge factor right now in Mubarak's decision to have the vice president go and talk because the military has said they will not fire on the civilians. What is the relationship, the civilian relationship with the army all about?
I think it's very positive, and I want to agree with Omar on the Muslim Brothers. I think the Muslim Brotherhood has been demonized in the United States out of all rational proportion. It's often and has been for decades led by legal jurists and all kinds of adult and very sensible people. They are very religious, as there are very religious people running in all across the American political spectrum also. I think the Muslim Brothers have consistently argued that the Egyptian government needs to take into account the interests of the Egyptians, much more so than the interests of the United States or Israel. And that has led the West to demonize them as somehow crazy people. But I think that's just propaganda. And I think Egyptians will not, as Omar reflects, won't share that view of the Muslim Brothers. And if they're excluded, people know why they're excluded. It's because the army and people like Mubarak saw them as their primary threat and the way to get the Americans off their back. Talking about democracy was to say that the Muslim Brothers are an unacceptable partner. I think the army's relationship with the Muslim Brothers is a complicated one. Ever since Nasser, the primary mobilizing group other than the army is the Muslim Brothers, and they recruit from the very same crew of people, young men out of middle and lower middle class areas, either go into the Muslim Brothers or they can go into the military. It was people from within the military that assassinated Sadat. I think that unlike in Pakistan and Turkey, where the army made some, particularly in Pakistan, an alliance with the Islamic groups, in Egypt the army has tried to stay separate from the Islamic groups, but recognizing that they're recruiting the same kids, one who's the cousin of the other or the brother. And so you see them climbing on the tanks here. I think it's an ominous sign for Mubarak if he thinks these army soldiers are then going to kill people in the community. I just don't think that's going to happen. He's going to have to rely on his police force and his sort of black-shirted security guards who may fire on the crowds.
Right. I think when the military said they're not going to fire, that doesn't mean that others won't fire. I think they're just saying they won't fire on.
Well, the security forces are known for their violence and their ruthlessness, and yet I don't hear a lot about them in the last few days.
It's very strange. They've seemed to have retreated. I've heard or read that they've come out again.
Okay. for the hunt, for the million person march today?
Well, actually, I just come back and stay on the roads and guide traffic and as checkpoints. They're not yielding their batons and all of that. So they are back. I don't know whether it was when they slipped away. It seemed maybe they were all scared and didn't want to walk around, or maybe they were just ordered back and then now they're ordered back out again. We will see.
614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And David from Bexley, you're on the air. You're a former Israeli soldier. Welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. I have a little different perspective on the whole issue. I'm not here to defend the president of Egypt. I'm just here to express my complete disappointment in our president here that put Mr. Mubarak under the bus so quickly after 5 days without realizing the whole ramification of this outburst of people in Egypt. Mubarak has been a friend of the United States and the Western world for 35 years. He was the stabilizing force in the entire Middle East. He's the one who maintained the peace process with Israel. He's the one who I personally had close cooperation with the military people in Egypt to control Hamas and the smuggling through the tunnels. And I cannot understand how the president and the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, will talk at two different voices and just talking about change and regime without realizing what it meant, what was going to mean the entire region there.
Yeah. All right, David.
I'm not saying he was the greatest. I don't think he should have done more. But you have to realize there are 80 million people living in Egypt. It's a poor country. There are millions of illiterate people.
Okay. Hang on, David. Let him respond. Thanks a lot for the call, too. The New York Times story this week suggested that the revolt in Egypt has thrown the Israeli government into a tizzy because kind of rethinking its most significant regional relationship. What does it bode?
Let me just say, clearly, the fact that Mubarak was loved by the West is fine, but as a president of Egypt, he has to be loved by his own people, and clearly that's not the case. I'm not concerned at all that there's going to be a war with Israel. I don't think there's anybody who has called for a war with Israel. I don't think the Egyptian military would even is even considering something that, or would even allow it. We benefit greatly from our alliance with the United States. We get military aid. We get U.S. military technology. In all my travels to Egypt, I have not seen anybody who said we got to restart the war with Israel. The Egyptians are very happy. We got the land back. Yes, it's a cold peace, but it's a peace treaty, not an agreement not to make war, not to make love. It takes a while to develop friendship with your neighbors, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm kind of surprised to hear somebody say that he's been a stabilizing force or kept the stability in the Middle East. I've always thought that the Middle East was unstable. So I don't.
I guess that's another relative term.
Yeah, I guess I don't see it that the same way. But I'm not worried that there's going to be a war with Israel or anything like that.
The Pew Center for the Study of the People in the Press reported the other day, and they reported it every time they poll, that about 85% of the Egyptians have a relatively unfavorable view of the United States, its foreign policy, and Israel. And 15% have a more favorable view. And as the caller said, Mubarak has been a good friend of the United States and a partner to Israel. And that's the problem. That it's way out of line with what the vast majority of the Egyptians would prefer. Our aid to Egypt has been very largely military and relatively small amounts to civil society and economic development. It creates the impression, probably rightly, because it is the situation, that the Americans have paid a lot of money to Mubarak, the military at the very highest echelons. With economic growth these last 5 years, much of which is not very much distributed across, as the caller said, this very poor country, it creates the impression that the United States and Israel tried to buy the leadership of Egypt and get them against the interests of Egypt to make positions that were accommodating to the United States and Israel. And you see, as Omar was saying, a public that says, we want an Egyptian leader that reflects what Egyptians want, not what Israel wants or what America wants. So I think the call is right. If and when this transition occurs, what comes next is likely to be much less friendly to the United States, much less friendly to Israel, and much more popular in Egypt. And I think that's what the United States is going to be wrestling with over the next couple of years when this, as this goes forward. Or we're going to have to try to put the cork back in the bottle, so to speak. It's not stability. It's simply repressing political development and giving the illusion of stability under which there's a human volcano waiting to erupt at any moment. And that's been the situation for 15 years now.
We have to take a quick break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation about what's going on in Egypt. If you have a question or comment, you're welcome to join 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us. From Mission Impossible to Columbo and Dragnet, TV crime dramas are a genre that transformed the pace of television, making gritty, quick dialogue and dramatic close-up camera shots popular. Watch Pioneers of Television crime dramas tonight at 8 on WOSU-TV. Currently 29 degrees in downtown Columbus. Periods of freezing drizzle and freezing rain likely this afternoon. An additional ice accumulation of around a tenth of an inch is possible. And then rain and freezing rain tonight with isolated thunderstorms possible. An additional ice accumulation of up to a quarter of an inch. And a low right around 30 degrees for tonight.
Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from Kappa, presenting Drumline Live. The music team behind the movie Drumline brings the explosive energy of their 39-member cast to the stage February 1st at the Palace Theater. Details and tickets at kappa.com.
All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about what's going on in Egypt today. It's a million-person march in Liberation Square in Cairo. You'll be hearing about that all day, I'm sure, if you pay attention to the news. We're talking about it right now with Richard Herman. He is the director of the OSU Mershon Center for International Security Studies. Also, Omar Keshk. He's a senior lecturer in Ohio State University's Undergraduate International Studies Program in the Department of Political Science. Question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. There are a lot of questions here to talk about, but after all these three-plus decades of repression and before that, there's no obvious successor to him. And Rick, as you mentioned, there's no dictator in the wings is what that translates into, but who does take up the yoke to get them through a transition?
This is, I think, what the United States and the leaders in Egypt need to be thinking about. I think that there isn't a charismatic leader, and we're probably glad for that, that can mobilize either the opposition in the Muslim direction or in the other nationalistic direction. So we have an opportunity here for, I think, a transition that's orderly. I think one of the big mistakes that the United States made in the Iranian Revolution when I was just finishing graduate school a long time ago was that we didn't plan for transition. So unlike the previous caller who said we're throwing Mubarak under the bus too early, from the American perspective, we need to decide when he's already under the bus. Nothing that we can do is going to change that and start dealing with the people who are going to be the future of Egypt. And I think had we done that in Iran earlier, we would have been better off.
Well, in Iran, it was a little bit different because we were the focus of the animosity, politically
yes.
and emotionally and psychologically.
You were a little bit different from that.
Yeah.
But I think the degree to which the United States is not seen by Egyptians as in favor of democracy and in favor of Egyptians determining Egyptians' future, we're going to be on the wrong side of this. And so I think there are a number of transitions strategies being talked about. The opposition has already proposed one. El Baradei has proposed one. I saw this morning John Kerry, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he's proposed a different one.
Right.
And I think that's exactly where the conversation will go in the next couple of weeks.
614-292-8513 if you want to join the conversation. And Dale from North Columbus, welcome to the show.
Hey, glad to be there. I'm a political scientist or anything like that. I'm kind of a political junkie. For the moment, as what's going on right now, I really don't have any answers. I would think that hopefully it would be peaceful and positive, okay, and that everyone should just kind of stand down and let things unfold in a possible way. But a peaceful way. But in a broad aspect, when the president's inauguration speech, he used the phrase about being on the wrong side of history. And unfortunately, the United States in a lot of situations have been that way. In the paradigm shift that is going on in the world, past, present, and future, coming together, we are reaping, and the White House has to deal, kind of walk a fine line here, but we're reaping kind of the same results that we did by back in Shaw as an example, or the Taliban as an example, and that didn't really turn out in either case the way we expected. And I think that's why we need to just take a deep breath and, again, walk this fine line in terms of the White House. We don't want to be on the wrong side of history.
Not this time.
We want to get in front of history and not on the wrong side like we've been.
Okay. Thank you, Dale.
Julie.
Omar?
Yeah, I'm glad he used the term wrong side of history. The United States has been advocating democracy for a long time, and Egyptians have believed them for a long time, but I think it's time, the expression I believe, to walk the walk. And I think the United States should say what's most important is that we have a democracy in Egypt. Yes, we may have a government or if people in Egypt who don't see eye to eye with us on every issue, but we don't see eye to eye with France or other democracies, and that has not that's not a problem.
But when it's in the Middle East, when it's in that region of the world, there seems to be so much
but
more
I think
at stake.
That Egyptians, I think Egyptians would really don't like that kind of statement because it seems to be that democracy is fine for everybody else, but we can't handle it or our democracy won't be a good democracy. And I don't think that's right to make exceptions. We either want to advocate democracy for everybody in the world, no matter where, or if we're going to start being exclusive like that, then I think Egyptians will turn away from democracy.
614-292-8513. If you want to give us a call, my guest, Richard Herman, he is the director at OSU Mershon Center for International Securities and Security Studies, and also Omar Keshk. He is the senior lecturer at OSU's Undergraduate International Studies Program. We're talking about Egypt. And caller from Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
First of all, I'd like to mention that I went to graduate school at OSU some many, many years ago with an Egyptian friend who is still teaching at the University of Cairo in criminology. And so I have a strong personal interest in what's happening since last week. And my feeling is that as a superpower, we should stay out and let these each country exercise their the natural self-governing right to determine their own government, and we should just let them be, and we should wait till they decide how they're going to form their new destiny, and we should not interfere until then. Second point I would like to question I would like to ask is this. What impact this self-determining events taking or changing the face of Middle East, what impact would that have on our policy on terrorism? You know, terrorism was initiated from the disaffected youth in the Middle East, and this self-generated rebellion against their own government, does that have an impact on the terrorism?
Maybe you're talking about the recruitment of terrorists, that kind of a thing?
I'm talking about, generally speaking, world terrorism. Usually it's generated from Middle Eastern disaffected citizens coming and trying to blame Western countries for their plight. And I wonder if this successful, I think it's going to be successful outcome in Cairo, in Egypt, perhaps this might have a direct impact on Middle Eastern terrorism.
Okay. Rick?
Let me make 2 points. First, with regard to the desire to stay out, I think talk shows like this and all over the country now, Americans are interested in what's going on in Egypt, but the reality is we're not going to have very much influence over it. This is going to be determined by the Egyptians. So I can listen to people who think the Muslim Brothers should be in or be out, or that we should have a transition strategy for this or that or the next thing. But I think, frankly, the amount of leverage the United States has anymore over the developments of what's going on in Egypt are pretty thin. And part of that is, as Omar and others have been saying, you know, we had 30 years to try to engineer reform. We didn't do that. And now other forces have taken control, and they're moving on their own dimension. And our credibility in this, I think, is pretty much shot.
So even if Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, comes out and whatever she says or whatever the president says at this point, it's better to say little or nothing at all, Omar?
Not little or nothing, but just to support the Egyptians and say let them determine for themselves what they want out of this, who's to be in whatever coalition they're going to form. I think that would be the best.
In a practical sense, unless we want to put in our troops from Iraq into Egypt or into the midst of all of this, so we're not going to be able to do much. With regard to terrorism, I think it's a mixed bag in this regard, that the changes that are coming now in Egypt are not because of the United States, but despite it. So I don't think it will be perceived that the United States has engineered this change or even favored this change for democracy or just reform and change in Egypt. So I think a lot of people will conclude that it was the protest and even maybe some of the violence against the regime that led to political transition, and that could take an anti-American form. Also, as we saw in Iran, once governments are free to speak what they want to say and the dictator is gone, then they will use that to mobilize anti-American and anti-Israeli sentiment. And that won't promote terrorist groups, but it could promote that sentiment that underpins it. What we've seen in Iran after 30 years is that the general public no longer blames us for their country's problems, but their country's state actually supports opposition and terror groups. The same could happen in Egypt, I suppose. I don't think so, but that's possible. I don't think this will, in a sense, let off steam, and now all the Arabs will like Americans better. I think what we might see, however, is that transitions not only in pro-American regimes like Egypt are stimulated. President Assad in Syria, which is one of our more adversarial states, he is announcing that he needs to make reforms. I think, you know, the real problem here is that for the last 40 years or so, 50 in Egypt's case, militaries have been in power or kings everywhere. And there's been simply no strategies for transition, change, reform of any kind. And people have simply fed up with it all across the region. And those regimes that are now vulnerable to this and the contagion that this could include are going to be scared that the kind of privileged position of unchallenged power, those days could be coming to an end.
Cade from Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I am not a Muslim, but I have a little problem. I see people crying, this Muslim can have the power. First, they can't have, they are a minority, they are 20%, I think. But why these people were not crying when Netanyahu was helped by the extreme religions in Israel, and he is now, right now, doing what all they tell him to do.
You're saying because he's a religious leader, that he's supported by the... Is that what you're saying?
Now people are crying because they said that the religious in Egypt can have the power.
Okay.
First, they will not have the power. And second, why these people did not cry when Netanyahu was helped by the religious, by the extreme religious in Israel? And until now, he is doing all what they tell him to do.
It's not religion per se. I think that people, I don't get the sense that it's religion and religious leaders per se. It's that it's Muslim religious leaders that people seem afraid of.
I think that's what the caller is trying mm-hmm. to point out, because if you look at the foreign minister of Israel currently, he's not a very nice person. The Dutch elected is a Geert Wilder. The French have Le Pen. And why is it that, and I don't know, I'm sure there are some in the Muslim Brotherhood who hold these kind of racist point of views, mm-hmm. but if these are allowed, if these other people are allowed to participate in a democracy, why can't the Muslim Brotherhood participate in a democracy? And I think that's why it's important not to say to exclude the Muslim Brotherhood, because I think that would be a bad start to the democracy. Also, if I could add, I would like to distinguish between what in Egypt, most Egyptians love American people. It is the American government's policies in the Middle East that are in this. And that's the kind of anti-American I think we will see is a greater nose to the United States and its wishes with respect to policies in the Middle East. But I think on a people level, I think the Egyptians have always loved Americans. And again, there's always a 5% that
sure.
don't like anybody.
Everybody
but,
can.
You know, when I go to Egypt, the doorman, everybody is always asking me about America and fascinated by it and all that kind of stuff. And I don't pick up a hatred for American people per se. But when it comes to the government policies, then it's something else.
Mm-hmm. Rick?
I don't think as far as U.S. foreign policy is concerned, the issue has ever been anti-Islam or anti-Muslim. I think we get confused because we want to put it in terms that frankly just make it harder to understand. We don't want anti-American governments. We don't want anti-Israeli governments. The religion has almost nothing to do with it. When we can use those religious movements to our benefit, as we did in the 1990s, we supported the Muslim Brothers in Jordan. We supported them in the 80s in Syria because we thought they would destabilize anti-American governments. We supported very conservative Islamic groups in Afghanistan for nearly a decade because we thought they could destabilize there a government supported by the Soviet Union. We supported extreme Islamic movements in Pakistan and had for decades. And now we're reaping the whirlwind that has left us because it was a good anti-Soviet move. Now some of these movements which are anti-American get populist base by using religious symbols. We saw that in Iran, and we saw that we're seeing it maybe in Egypt at some point. But these same Muslim Brothers who were afraid of in Egypt were our allies in Syria. And what I think you really need to keep your eye on here, and as you saw it from the caller from Israel earlier, people are worried that the regime will be anti-American. And I think we just got to call it like it is. It has nothing to do with Islam. It's just we don't want a regime that will be more difficult for us to deal with and that will be tougher on its Israeli policies or on Saudi Arabia and the demand for change in Saudi Arabia, which would be next in line. If this can't stand in Egypt, well, then why not have democracy also in Saudi Arabia, which, by the way, just to finish my point here, is about the most religious, conservative Muslim state on the face of the earth.
And one of our best friends.
And one of our best friends.
Best friends forever.
I think that's an excellent point by Rick, because I think maybe in the Middle East people view it as anti-Islam, but in reality it is. And as a superpower and as any country, we don't want people who are anti-American interest, anti-Israeli interest. And maybe a discussion if in that perspective rather than making it as anti-Muslim would be much better and lead us down the right direction.
Well, that's all the time we have for the discussion right now. I want to thank my guests today. Richard Herman, he is director of the OSU Mershon Center for International Security Studies. Thanks for joining us, Rick.
Thank you for having me.
And also Omar Kashki is a senior lecturer in OSU's Undergraduate International Studies Program. Omar, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
And
it was
best
a pleasure.
Wishes for your family
you
in Egypt. We'll be right back with some music and some rhythm. So stay with us. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Listen to local news from the award-winning WOSU News team and national news from NPR on the new 89.7 NPR News. And be sure to enjoy the best in classical music on the new Classical 101. Classical music all day, every day. It's all news on 89.7 NPR News and all classical on Classical 101. For more information and to stream our services online, visit WOSU.org.
This is 89.7 NPR News. In 20 minutes, Hour 2 of All Sides with Ann Fisher begins, and we'll hear about humanitarian relief and human rights in a post-9/11 world. Join that discussion on All Sides beginning at 11 o'clock. And WOSU Public Media presents the Columbus Metropolitan Club's Wednesday Forum. Wednesday at noon, it's Electric Cars Might Drive Our Future, featuring the director of Ohio State Center for Automotive Research. Tickets and more information available at columbusmetroclub.org. 29 degrees in downtown Columbus, periods of freezing drizzle and freezing rain this afternoon. A slight ice accumulation is possible. And then rain and freezing rain tonight with also a chance of a thunderstorm. An additional ice accumulation tonight of up to a quarter of an inch, and lows right around 30 degrees tonight. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. As a former bandy from high school, I love listening to that music. It's from Drumline Live. It's a musical inspired by the movie Drumline. It's Drumline Live is scheduled to be in Columbus tonight. So we're going to talk about what inspired Drumline in the first place. Joining us to talk about that and the enduring appeal of this Drumline storyline is Drumline Live company manager Reggie Brand. Welcome to the show, Reggie.
Thank you, Ann.
And also, Brian Snell. Brian is the Drumline Live Assistant Musical Director. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you so much.
Let's talk about the tradition of the show-style marching bands. It surely didn't come from where I'm from in Michigan. It came from the southeast part of the country. Tell us about that now. Brian or Reggie?
Right. I guess I can take that. Yeah, the traditional or show-style type marching bands was, you know, birthed from the HBCU culture, you know, historically black colleges and universities, primarily in the southeast. Basically, we just kind of took the traditional marching band and just tried to make it as relevant and appealing to our particular crowds as we could by infusing modern-day music and choreography of the day into what we were doing. And it's kind of it's been something that's been around for, you know, 60-plus years, and it's really, really taken off, and it's become it's actually, you know, it's an American art form, mm-hmm. and it's just really taken off. And, you know, Drumline, the movie, was one of the first commercial forms that it was, you know, shared across the nation, across the world, and we're kind of, you know, a spinoff of the success of that, and we just want to just take this art form and just share it with everyone that we can.
Brian, were you in a show-style marching band?
Yeah, I was in a show-style, a traditional-style marching mm-hmm. band, and in high school, and also in college, Florida A&M University, and my father was before me, and it's kind of a tradition in the community where I'm from, and it's just something that that's very special to us, and we just enjoy it a lot.
Well, most of us have to give up our band careers in high school, President Company included, and most of us then, the rest of us, give it up in college, but this must feel like an eternal childhood right now.
It absolutely does. Sometimes I have to pinch myself uh-huh. in the morning when I get up, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to band practice, and I'm actually going to, you know, get a paycheck, you know, for doing this. This is my life. But it's an extraordinary thing because it gives, you know, talented musicians an opportunity to continue to do what they've been doing, you know, for almost half their lives, continue that and to make a career out of it and to be able to travel the world and share their musical gifts with people. You know, it's a shame that, you know, at age 21 or 22, you know, when you graduate from college, you know, most people are pretty much aged out mm-hmm. of something that they've been training themselves to, you know, perfect for so many years, and that's pretty much it. But this gives people an opportunity, like I said, to continue that and take it to another level and just continue to just to share the gift of music with everyone.
Reggie, were you in a show-style band, marching band?
No, I wasn't.
So what's it like managing a show like this?
I'm one of the few that kind of came from the outside, and I'm the business side of this and the operations and trying to make things work and taking these artistic people and trying to realize and say, hey, we actually have to make this financially fit and work.
Mm-hmm. Got to pay the bills.
Yeah, well, they want to put at least 100 people on stage if they could. You know, they want to. Although we have a full marching band, they think it's not enough. So,
tell us about the band. Tell us about what all you do, and if there's a storyline. I haven't seen it, and tell us about what happens on stage.
And I want to emphasize that it's a full band. It's just not a drum line. It's a full marching band with instrumentation, trumpets, trombones, tubas, brass. So we have a full brass band along with percussion. And we take you through a journey, a musical journey of all genres of music, having a marching band perform those. So it's a musical journey beginning from the beginning of kind of an African theme all the way through to your hip-hop generation. We take you through gospel. We take you through big band era. So it's a musical journey, and it's one that we think is family oriented. From ages 8 to 80, you have something that you'll enjoy and have fun with during the show, and it's very interactive.
Sometimes when I'm listening to particularly high school marching bands, but it's true of college as well, it feels awkward sometimes, the music they pick. It's pop music, and it just feels awkward when they're doing a Rolling Stones song or something. It just doesn't work for me. How do you make it work, and how do you pick what you're going to adapt to the style?
Well, and that's one of the key things is picking the right song. Mm-hmm. I think, and Brian will tell you in the band, that's one of the first things that's always discussed, and we hear those discussions on the bus trips about, oh, boy, yeah, that was a great song. That was a great selection. Right. Because you want to pick things that people love and they can feel and feel the music and want to feel the music and move with the music. So we think we picked the right songs. And we also, it's the arrangements and the way the songs are written and the style that they're played. That's one of the differences, I think, in HBCU's band marching bands and the show-style marching bands is the arrangements and the style that's used. We've heard some of the same songs played, and you listen to it, and you're like, boy, it's a big difference. Hal Leonard actually picked up one of the songs that we have in the show and said it's just the style and the way it was arranged that has so much soul to it. So it has a lot to do with that, along with the choreography. I mean, when you see choreography, when you just stand and play versus dancing and playing at the mm-hmm. same time, it gives you a little more feel, and you want to interact more with the music.
Any chipped teeth?
That makes a difference.
Yeah, it's certainly physical. It's an extremely physically demanding show, and sometimes it's almost like a sport. Yeah, and mm-hmm. as we have muscle pulls and sprains and injuries and sometimes like that, but we know we try to approach it like athletes and take care of our bodies and, mm-hmm. and warm up and stretch, and because it's very physically involved. But we knock on wood, we have everyone's pretty healthy.
Do you get songs from the HBCU? HBCUs. I mean, do you pick up songs from them, or are you inspired by them and create your own repertoire of music? Brian?
Well, it's kind of both. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're all from HBCU, so we know what we played
right
when we were in the in the bands in the colleges. So a lot of times what we try to do also in the show is to kind of give a nod to some of the, to certain HBCUs in existence. We'll play a song that one school may be, known for.
Okay.
And it's kind of almost like a greatest hits.
Okay.
Of the HBCUs and different songs, and we as Reggie was alluding to, it's a musical journey, but the different styles, we're basically showing you the different styles and different genres of music that we all pull from. If you go to an average game, we have something in the HBCU where we call the fifth quarter, that it occurs after the game, and basically the fans assemble in front of the bands and the field, and the bands just play sometimes up to 10 minutes, up to an hour or two after the game. And we're going to touch on all genres of music. You'll hear a little bit of gospel. You may hear hip-hop, swing, classical. You may hear an excerpt from an opera. We just jump around and we give you so much variety. So somebody's going to get something. And we pride ourselves in being able to just give so much variety in our music. And we try to reflect that in our show and show you all the motivations and all the inspirations and styles that we pull from.
Yeah, historically, black colleges and university marching bands were started, like everywhere else, to support the college football teams, but they've since grown into, as you pointed out, like a sport of their own. And I'm trying to figure out when you mentioned, I think, Reggie, that it was about 60 years ago that it started to emerge on its own as a event and as a fifth quarter, as you put it, Brian?
Well, yeah, it's 60 years ago is kind of when it became this art form became in existence, and Florida A&M was one of the key HBCUs to start it, and then it just evolved from, you know, Southern University in Louisiana,
Tennessee State,
Grambling in Louisiana, Jackson State in Jackson, Mississippi. It's just those began to all have their own styles. You know, they had some great band directors of their time who evolved and created their own unique style for each one of those. And it's one of those things where you could almost hear the music and immediately know, oh, that's Tennessee State, oh, that's FAM, oh, that's Southern. So and then you see the marching style. They evolved to have
best bands in the parade,
styles. And show styles. And when they went on a show and when they did a halftime show, it was different. So they all evolved into these unique art forms. And eventually people began to come to the games to see the battle between the bands. The football game became secondary, and halftime is the biggest thing, and then it evolved into the stands being the next part of the musical experience or the experience of the football game. And as Brian said, the fifth quarter evolved because people didn't want them to stop. And also the battle between. It's the biggest thing in the game is not always who won the football game. It was also who won the battle between the bands. Right. And the great thing is it's no score, so everybody wins, of course, whoever their favorite is. But there's at least a 2 to 3 hour argument over, well, that song was better than that song. No, that was better than this. And because we have a bus full of different folks from different bands and different schools, we hear that on the bus quite often.
Well, during football season, it's got to be tough.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I just want to tell our listeners that Drumline Live, it will be at the Palace Theater tonight. There are tickets still available. You can call. We'll have a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to check out the tickets. And there are student age tickets as well. So check that out. Go to WOSU.org/allsides. The show recruits its performers from historically black colleges and universities. What do you look for? And is there a lot of competition to get in the show?
Well, we have very limited slots. We have only 37 people. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it's very competitive. We're looking for the best musicians. But not only musicianship. We're looking for you got to be able to dance. I mean, you got to be able to move. You got to be able to march and play. And several of our people are extremely talented. They're multi-talented. They sing, they can dance, and they play multiple instruments.
Right. Everybody has to do several things. Yeah.
Right.
It's not good enough just to be able to play well. You have to be able to, play more than, multiple instruments, and you're be physically coordinated. It's a large part of the show, being in the physical condition to do the choreography and everything that's required. Is a large part of it. And even, just theatrically acting and your personality coming across, in the stage because we're in a theatrical environment. It's quite a bit that we're looking for. It's getting more competitive.
Yeah. Are you still recruiting all the time? I don't know how long you've been on the road.
We're constantly. We have a website. We're constantly accepting video auditions. And we meet people all the time who are interested in the production. And, so you can always go online and the requirements are there. So we're always in a state of kind of constant casting, mm-hmm. But when the positions become available, we'll go ahead and fill those slots if they're open, if someone's qualified to meet that on the next tour.
We're just always looking for talented people.
I mean,
you can never have enough talent, and we're always looking because it's tough. It's very tough to find the talent that we're looking for. Although there are several bands, it's still hard to find what we need.
How many? Now you're the only show, Drumline Live. You're the only production company out there doing this right now.
We're very unique. I mean, we're the only marching band that's on stage. at this point, and definitely with our style. There's a production called Blast.
Okay.
That took the DCI type of style, and they put it on stage for several years and were very successful. And we looked at that as a model and kind of said, hey, guys, let's put our style out there. But we're one of the few. And, you know, that's one of the things we talked about the other day with our production team, our management team, is that you don't see a lot of live music now.
Mm-hmm.
And we're playing live music every night. We did two shows the other day, and one of the promoters told me, "God, you guys are playing for 4 hours. Usually, we can't get people to want to play for half an hour on an instrument. Well, mm-hmm. My chops are tired. I'm dead."
Right. It's rigorous.
We do that. We play, and we play live music and energetic music, and we're very interactive with the audience.
Tell me about that. I was going to ask you about what kind of interactive. You know, what do you mean by that?
I mean, we take it out to the audience. We're in the house playing with the audience. We want you to get up and groove and dance with us when we're in. So we take it to the audience several times throughout the show. We get the audience to participate in part of our show. We don't want to reveal all of the secrets.
Okay.
But we have them come on stage and become part of our show. And then we end the show with a New Orleans-style parade, where we get the audience to come out into the lobby, and uh-huh. and we do that. You know, we bring that New Orleans feel to the venue and to the lobby, and do a little jazz and licks out there. So we get to meet everyone. So we're with the audience, and the audience is a part of our show.
What do your audiences look like? A lot of high school kids right now.
Our audience
very diverse.
Really?
Very diverse.
I mean, I just think that it would be a big attraction to, you know, just to see something like that instead of, you know.
That's a part of it. Like, mm-hmm. like Reggie said, 8 to 80.
Yeah, okay.
Black, white, purple, green, you name it. We have the most diverse audiences, I think, probably of any production that may be around right now. What do you think, Reggie?
I agree. I mean, we look at the audience sometimes and we're kind of astounded. We uh-huh. were initially, right. when we did 2 years ago, we were kind of shocked. We
right.
did one of the shows in a community called Kerrville, Texas, where it's a retirement community.
Oh, okay.
And we sold out two shows, and the average age probably was 60.
Well, there is only one show tonight at the Palace Theater in Columbus, so if you want to catch it, you can go to WOSU.org/allsides. You can go to our link there and find out how to get tickets. I want to thank my guests right now, Brian Snell, musical director for Drumline, or assistant musical director for Drumline Live. Thank you, Brian, for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Reggie Brand, he is the company manager for Drumline Live. Let's listen to some more music, and thanks for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.